This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 21st of January, these are our main stories. The Sri Lankan President, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, has for the first time acknowledged that more than 20,000 people missing since the end of the civil war 10 years ago are dead. A court in Canada has begun hearing the United States' request for the extradition of the Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou, a case that's caused a diplomatic rift between Ottawa and Beijing. And as we record this podcast, hundreds of Central American migrants are in a standoff with Mexican border forces after being repulsed as they tried to cross into Guatemala. Also in this podcast, as the impeachment trial of President Trump is due to start, we hear from one of the Democratic presidential hopefuls having to clear their campaign schedule to head back to the Senate.
Is it a disadvantage? Absolutely. We're going to do our best to compensate for that. And, you know, we'll be out on weekends. We do the best that we can.
And
if two people were to accidentally drop a slice of bread at exact opposite points of the globe, would it form the Earth into a sandwich?
That's the story of two men on opposite sides of the world who tried to make what they're calling an Earth sandwich. In the last few days of the Sri Lankan civil war, tens of thousands of people, some Tamil Tiger militants, but mostly Tamil civilians, were trapped in a small area in the north of the country. When the war ended, they had disappeared, and it was widely claimed that they were being kept in secret prisons by the Sri Lankan armed forces. Now the Sri Lankan President, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, has acknowledged for the first time that thousands of those who disappeared during the civil war are dead. More from our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Ettirajan.
After the end of the civil war, that many Tamil civilians were demanding answers from the government about the relatives who went missing during the war and also after the war ended. More than 23,000 people were officially listed as missing. This also included about 5,000 to 6,000 soldiers. When I was speaking with the senior Sri Lankan government officials, they were saying, you know, many of those who killed when a big artillery shell exploded, these bodies just went, you know, missing. They went into pieces. So many of them cannot be accounted for. However, on the part of the Tamil civilians and former Tamil Tiger cadres, when I spoke to many of the families last year in Sri Lanka, they said they were separated as soon as the war ended in a small sliver of land in the northeastern part of Sri Lanka, when, you know, thousands of people were crammed inside this area. They came out and surrendered. At that time, they said the military was separating the civilians and the Tamil Tiger cadres. And many said, we saw my son, my son-in-law, my daughter-in-law surrendering to the army, and they were taken in a bus, and we have not heard anything from them. Now the government says that all of them are dead. But the families insist, for a long time they believed they were kept in some secret prison somewhere in Sri Lanka. That is what was happening for the last 10 years. Now, the announcement by the Sri Lankan President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who was the defense minister at the time of the war, it is now clearly says that all of them will be considered as dead.
So how significant is the fact that he's now announced this, and how will it be received by the families of the disappeared?
First and foremost, this will be a great shock for the families of those disappeared, because they were hoping, as we speak, you know, many of the families were holding roadside protests in towns like Kilinochi in the northern part of Sri Lanka, in Batticolo in the eastern part of Sri Lanka, for more than 2 years, holding the pictures of their loved ones, hoping that the international attention or the pressure would help them to find them somewhere in hospitals, some secret prisons or somewhere. The previous government set up an office of the missing persons, but they couldn't make much progress because the government, this army, the military, there were so many departments. It was difficult to coordinate all these departments. Now, this will bring an end.
It brings a closure, but why has Mr. Rajapaksa done it now, and will there be further repercussions?
No, the government has been under pressure to find out what really happened to those missing people. We're talking about nearly, you know, more than 20,000 people, many of them Tamil civilians. It also comes just weeks before the UN Human Rights Council meeting in Geneva, where the Sri Lankan issue is likely to come up once again. Now, the government also wants to put an end, to put a full stop to all these inquiries and say, now these people are dead, we have to move on. But many Tamils would not agree, because they would want to know under what circumstances these people died, if they were for example, allegedly killed in extrajudicial killings, they would want an inquiry and they would want to know what circumstances these people were taken into custody and how they died. But these questions will remain. This is not going to end. Maybe officially this will bring an end to the deaths. On the other hand, the families will continue to have questions.
Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Ithirajan. A court in Canada is hearing the extradition case of the Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou, who's facing charges in the United States of fraud and violating American sanctions on Iran. As we record this podcast, Ms. Meng watched from behind bulletproof glass as her lawyer argued that she had not violated Canadian law as Ottawa did not apply sanctions on Iran. Zoe Thomas is in Vancouver.
Meng Wanzhou arrived in court looking confident and ready to face the charges against her. Her defense team have mainly focused on an aspect of the law called double criminality, arguing that she should not be extradited because the sanctions violations she is accused of are not crimes in Canada. Lawyers for Canada's Attorney General have tried to focus on the allegations of bank fraud. The case has been a highly political one since her arrest more than a year ago. Her supporters were gathered outside the court, as were protesters, some holding anti-China signs.
Zoe Thomas. As we record this podcast, hundreds of Central American migrants are in a standoff with Mexican border forces as they try to cross from Guatemala. It's the first major challenge to the Mexican government's pledge to help the United States contain mass movements of migrants. Some of the group waded across the river into Mexico, clashing with waiting security forces. But one woman traveling with her husband and three children said that most of the group never planned to storm the border.
That's a lie. We're going to wait here until they open the gates, until the president gives us a solution. All of this is peaceful. It's not about violence. We've already planned this.
The group of migrants are massed on a bridge connecting the two countries. Jeff Abbott is a freelance journalist traveling with the group.
They waited on the bridge, and when they were requesting that the Mexican authorities permit the entire caravan to pass through. But Mexican authorities stated that they would only permit 20 people at a time to pass through. And as a result, the caravan made a decision to cross the river Suchiate, which divides Mexico and Guatemala. The situation is really tense here. The Mexican National Guard has been deployed. There was a brief period of a clash between the migrants and the National Guard. Number of people were injured. But right now, it's kind of in a standoff.
You will have spoken to some of these migrants. Do most of them want to grow on towards the United States? Is that their goal?
A lot of them do, but there's actually a surprising number of people who are just hoping of finding work in Mexico. The conditions in Honduras have deteriorated drastically in the last 10 years since the coup d'etat in 2009. The cost of life has gone up. People are not earning a sufficient amount to be able to pay the bills. And people see Mexico and even the United States as a better opportunity.
And what are people telling you about what they're going to do facing this situation? Are they going to remain there, try to keep making these crossings, or are they going to turn back?
Currently, it's unclear. Right now, a lot of people are in shock. I've interviewed a couple of people who began crying as they recounted what just occurred. So right now, it's unclear what will happen. Currently, as I'm speaking, there's more National Guard troops arriving. It's too early to say what the plan going forward will be. I know that most people who are here just want to reach Mexico.
And what are those people who you're talking to telling you about why they've chosen to take this rather difficult and dangerous trek?
Generally, they're saying lack of opportunity. To point out that there's very few jobs in Honduras. I've spoken with a number of kids who are young men who were working to support their family and barely making enough to support the family. Like one kid I talked to, worked, him and his brother worked, and one paid the rent for the house, the other paid for food, and at the end of every month, there was no money left over. Added to that, there's the problem of corruption. Honduras has a massive problem with corruption within the highest levels of government. Attempts to limit corruption have been weak at best. On top of all that, there's also the problem of violence, gangs, criminal groups, problem with narco-trafficking, etc. So it's a combination of many factors that are pushing people out.
Jeff Abbott from the Guatemala-Mexico border. Offices around the world have notoriously different work cultures. Here in the UK, for example, not offering to make the tea is seen as an office crime. Oh, that reminds me. But in China, one company had a policy of dressing in drag and dancing at work when ordered to, and has sacked an employee who refused to join in. A video being posted on Chinese channels shows two other employees taking part in black pantyhose, or black sheer tights, as they're called in the UK. More from our China analyst, Carrie Allen.
It shows some male legs, two men dancing to the Pussycat Dolls, and people are asking, what is this? So what it is it was a end-of-year company event in an area called Shaoxing in Zhejiang province in the east of China, where these salesmen, because they didn't perform well, had to wear tights and dance as a form of punishment. And one guy said, I'm not doing this. And now it's all over the media today that he's been fired because he didn't want to put his tights on and dance.
How common or how regular is this type of activity in China?
I've seen quite a few cases of this, actually. I've seen cases in recent years of Chinese staff being made to, for example, drink urine, eat cockroaches, get down on all fours and kiss rubbish bins. Really degrading activities. But the idea is that in China, because it's such a big labour market, I mean, China's got a population of 1.4 billion people, that the job market is very competitive. And so there are companies that feel that they can make their employees show loyalty by making them do these degrading activities because they could very easily get rid of them.
Is the corporate culture there so cutthroat? And is there no intervention or way to regulate that type of activity?
A lot of people are saying that an investigation could be carried out into this company and that staff could get compensation because it's not very ethically correct. And especially things like, yeah, like in previous years where you've had people eating cockroaches, it's outright degrading. So there could be a case that both via public shaming online, but also pressures from, say, rights groups, labour rights groups, that this company could get shut down.
And this all comes as Chinese people are preparing to celebrate the Chinese New Year. So it must be a very bad time of the year to get fired.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that normally happens this time of year is that Chinese people get what's known as a hongbao, which is a red envelope with some money in. And it's an end of year bonus. And it's meant to be a gift to say, out with the old, in with the new. Here's some money to go and celebrate for what's China's version of, say, Christmas. It's a big festive time. But what you do get around this time of year is, because companies have to give such a large amount of money, these hongbao envelopes, that there are companies that try to get rid of staff so they don't have to give the money. So this might have been the case with Mr. Gao.
Carrie Allen. The Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam has decided a long-disputed self-portrait said to be by the artist is indeed the real thing. It's the only known picture Vincent Van Gogh painted, which shows him in a clearly depressed mental state. Here's our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd.
The 1889 picture, which belongs to the National Museum in Oslo, has now gone on display in Amsterdam, labelled self-portrait as a sick person. The Van Gogh Museum's been researching the portrait for several years, and it's finally come out against those who claimed it wasn't really a Van Gogh. The artist died at 37, having struggled at length with his mental well-being. Some of his self-portraits, and there are more than 30, show a handsome, resolute face, but this shows Vincent with head slightly bowed, mouth pursed, and the eyes listless, as if he wants to avoid the gaze of the spectator. It's the only work we know the artist produced during a psychotic episode, according to Louis van Tilburg of the Van Gogh Museum.
We see here a greenish tint for the hair, which he hardly ever uses. He's sick, he's ill here, so we want to emphasize that. So he uses formal tricks, you could say, to make this more intense.
The museum has concluded this is probably the picture Vincent describes in a letter in September 1889 to his brother Theo as an attempt from when I was ill. It would most likely have been painted in the asylum at Saint-Rémy-de-Provence, which Vincent entered voluntarily. In his lifetime, Vincent van Gogh was virtually unknown and he sold almost nothing. Yet today, countless people around the world find his work and troubled life endlessly fascinating.
That report by Vincent Dowd. You're listening to the Global News podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, pro-gun activists gather in the U.S. state of Virginia to protest against laws proposed by the state's Democrat-controlled legislature to limit access to guns in the state.
All these fine people with guns have the perfect right to have them. None of us are shooting anybody on the streets. Guns are good.
The World Health Organization will convene its emergency committee on Wednesday to discuss whether the outbreak in China of a new respiratory virus constitutes an international public health emergency. Just days ago, the WHO said it didn't see a need for an emergency meeting, but China has since confirmed human-to-human transmission of the novel coronavirus and outbreaks across the country. Currently, there are more than 200 cases, mostly in the central city of Wuhan, but also detected in Beijing, Shanghai, and Shenzhen, as well as Japan, Thailand, and South Korea. Three people have died. The head of the team investigating the outbreak, Zhang Nanshan, has told state television that human-to-human transmission has been confirmed. The BBC's Tim Frank spoke to Professor David Heyman of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He's worked for the Centers for Disease Control in the US and the World Health Organization. His first assignment was the first outbreak of the Ebola virus. So what goes through his mind when he hears of a new virus like this one?
Some of the people who were infected had contact with a specific market in Wuhan. Well, whenever an organism crosses the species barrier between a human and an animal, normally from an animal to a human, and causes disease in that human, there are many questions. First of all, is that a only disease like rabies and it won't spread further? Or is it a disease like Ebola, which will spread for a time and then stop? Or is it a disease like HIV, which emerged back in the early 20th century and then became an endemic disease, which is with people today? So there are many pathways that these emerging infections can take. And that's the first concern. Which pathway will it take? Second concern is it transmitting easily from human to human, or does it transmit with difficulty?
I know that you've got a particular expertise in terms of how bats are often a vector for the spread of these viruses. And I'm sort of bound to wonder whether you think that that may have played a part in this outbreak, if we're talking about how that could possibly involve somehow bats being part of the transmission process.
Well, bats have been very important in outbreaks in the past. Outbreaks, for example, of Ebola are thought to come from bats, either to an animal, which is then hunted in nature. The animal is infected. When a human butchers that animal, the blood infects the humans. There's a virus called the Nipah virus, which came from bats into pigs and into humans from the pigs. So they're either wild animals or domestic animals can play a role in transmission of an organism from a bat to a human. If animals were infected in the market, they could have been infected by bats who were also in the market, or they could have been infected in nature before they were brought into the market by bats, or they may have been infected from animal to animal. Animals also carry coronaviruses, but less virulent coronaviruses. And maybe there was a population of animals carrying less severe coronaviruses, and one of them mutated in such a way that it's caused this new infection to cross the barrier between animals and humans and infect humans. So it's not clear where it came from, and it's really not important if this is a one-time event. If there's continued transmission from animals to humans, then it's very important to know which animal. But right now, it looks like it's spreading within the human populations, and that's where the efforts must be made to stop it from transmitting from person to person.
And why is it that bats often play such a key role?
Well, bats have a very tolerant immune system, whereas immune systems in other animals are immediately on the alert to new organisms when they enter the human or the other animal, and they build antibody against them. Bats, for some reason, don't react the same way, and they tolerate these viruses which cause animals and humans to have poor health or disease, but in the bats themselves, they are healthy carriers.
David Heyman of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The impeachment trial of President Donald Trump starts in the U.S. Senate later today. Our correspondent, Jane O'Brien, has been speaking to two of the 100 senators who, as we record this podcast, are about to take on the role of jurors. And for them, it's particularly difficult timing, given that they're among the four senators vying for the Democratic presidential nomination, with voting about to start in Iowa and New Hampshire. From there, the BBC's Jane O'Brien.
A recent heart attack hasn't stopped Bernie Sanders, and neither has New Hampshire's frigid winter weather. But there's one campaign obstacle the 78-year-old senator from Vermont can't avoid: the impeachment trial in Washington.
Frankly, with a caucus coming up in Iowa in 2 weeks and a primary here in New Hampshire in 3 weeks, would rather be campaigning around here, doing a lot of town meetings and the things we had planned to do. That's not going to be the case. But I am very confident, both in New Hampshire and in Iowa, we have a really strong volunteer network. As we speak, people are knocking on doors, making the phone calls, and they're going to have to do what I can't do, and we look forward to winning in both states.
Senator, does the impeachment trial give Joe Biden an unfair advantage over you because he can keep on campaigning?
Look, as I said a moment ago, is it a disadvantage? Absolutely it is. We're going to do our best to compensate for that. And, we'll be out on weekends. We do the best that we can.
Bernie Sanders may be topping the polls in New Hampshire and Iowa, but former Vice President Joe Biden remains the candidate most likely to win enough delegates overall to secure the Democratic nomination. Sanders' supporters at this event in North Conway seem resigned.
How disruptive do you think this is going to be to his campaign?
It doesn't matter. That's his duty. He's a senator and he has to go and partake in the Senate trial.
I'm not that worried.
Do you think it's going to make any difference to how people think?
No.
I think it's important. I don't think it should detract from the election process, though.
I mean, it is, because Bernie Sanders and the other three senators are going to have to go back to Washington.
Yes, it's true. And I think that Bernie Sanders is a strong candidate, and being a senator is an important job. And we also, as citizens, recognize that he has to do both.
The impeachment trial affects four senators: Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, who's also a frontrunner, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, and Colorado's Mike Bennett. He staked his entire campaign on doing well in New Hampshire and will almost certainly leave the race if he doesn't. I caught up with him at a cafe in the state capital of Concord.
I don't think of it as unfair because there's nothing I can do about it. I've got a constitutional responsibility to fulfill. But I have been in New Hampshire more than any other candidate for president. I'm spending the time that I have to spend here, and I will do that around the impeachment trial as well.
When you talk to people on the campaign trail, though, do they really care about impeachment? Because there are so many other things that concern them.
People are mixed, I would say. I mean, there are people that clearly what people mostly care about is they're working really hard and they can't get themselves into a middle-class life. They feel like they can't afford housing, health care, higher education, early childhood education. On the other hand, there are a lot of people, and I'm one of them, that feel that this president has violated the standard of conduct, and we need to at least have a trial and an inquiry about this.
What will it have achieved if, as expected, the Senate acquits him?
I hope what it will have achieved is a reassertion of what our standard is. We will have the opportunity to do that, even if, as expected, the Republican majority will acquit the president.
Nobody knows how long the impeachment trial will last or which party will be hurt the most in the long run, but its impact on the Democratic primary campaign is already being felt.
Jane O'Brien. Staying in the U.S., and on Monday, thousands of gun rights activists, many carrying weapons, including assault rifles, congregated in Richmond, Virginia, to protest against proposed new laws that would limit the range and number of guns and rifles people could buy in the state. But these protesters said the measures violated their right to bear arms.
We're hoping that they're going to get the message that we're not going to put up with these laws. They can make all the laws they want pertaining to the Second Amendment. We're not going to obey them.
Why don't we get rid of cars? Drunk drivers get in cars and kill people. It's not the honest gun owner that kills people. It's the criminal that kills the people.
Police officers guarded the area with the help of bomb-sniffing dogs, and people entering the perimeter allocated to the protest through the single entrance were screened with metal detectors. Our correspondent at the rally, Aline Makboul, described what he had witnessed.
We saw lots of various militias from around the country deciding to descend on this rally, but actually it passed off very peacefully. People have just dissipated from the streets here. But there were thousands of people here, and most of them were carrying some kind of weapon, either handguns or rifles, sometimes multiple weapons. That is all perfectly legal here in Virginia, to be able to walk down streets in this downtown area and be able to carry weapons like that. And even though the politicians here are not threatening that, people here were still angry enough with the kind of small gun control measures which are being suggested here in Virginia. That's why there was such a big presence on the streets.
That's important to note. So what are they actually proposing?
What they're proposing is to limit people in Virginia to only be allowed to buy one weapon per month, and also to allow some localities to say that guns can be banned from certain public events. And the last thing they are proposing is that there should be gun checks when one gun owner sells on their weapon to somebody else.
Now, Virginia has been traditionally a Republican-leaning state, which has in recent years become more and more Democrat. So there's a political element to this as well, this being an election year?
There's no question that there's a political element to all of this. You know, a lot of the people today definitely saw their president as someone who was on their side. There were a lot of people in sort of Trump 2020 paraphernalia. In fact, Donald Trump tweeted just a couple of days ago to say that the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, was under attack in Virginia, which a lot of people saw as a call to attend this rally. But they see that while they have an ally in the White House, of course there are those people around the country who say, well, look, thousands and thousands of people are killed in gun violence in America every year. There are hundreds of mass shootings every year. So something has to be done. But you've seen here that even trying to tinker with the edges of gun rights causes this massive outrage. And this really is why so many people came out here, because they don't want other Democratic states to even try to do the same thing.
Aline Makboul in Richmond, the capital of Virginia. Seismologists in the Philippines are continuing to warn of the possibility of a hazardous eruption at Taal Volcano. The Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology say that frequent earthquakes and newly formed fissures in surrounding towns suggest the volcano is still in a dangerous phase. Howard Johnson sent this report from the border of the off-limit town Agoncillo, where he found some residents desperate to return home.
We're on the outskirts of Agoncillo here. The army here are enforcing a curfew between 6 a.m. till 10 a.m. That curfew has passed now, so they're allowing people to leave with their pets and their livestock, taking them out to safety.
We met one man dragging a cow by a rope. He'd fetched it because he is totally dependent on it to earn a living. With fissures and cracks appearing in roads, frequent earth tremors and clouds of volcanic ash swirling in the air, there's a palpable sense of danger here in Agoncillo. But despite this, many people are still trying to get back into the town to reclaim their valued possessions. This couple missed the strict army-imposed curfew and were refused entry. Emotions here are clearly running high. The government say more than 200,000 people have been affected by the volcanic eruption, and around half of them are now safely in evacuation centres like this one, 20 kilometres from Taal's danger zone.
I'm at the Alfonso Evacuation Centre. What it is basically is a covered basketball court with more than 400 evacuees, people who've left areas affected by Taal volcano. What the authorities have done here is give people little tents
to partition this area so they have some privacy to be with their families, to have their food together, and to make sure that they have some space to sleep easily at night.
Mary Garbin shows us her partitioned space. It's around 3 meters squared. In one corner, next to a pile of household belongings, her two daughters are eating lunch on the floor. Mary is grateful for the support, but says a week without home comforts has been incredibly difficult.
I've been scared because it's just us. It's just the three of us. If I don't hold it together, we are going to suffer. I have to be strong.
Mary's 12-year-old daughter, Alyssa Rose, was swimming into Owl Lake next to the volcano the day it erupted. She says a week without classes has been frustrating, but is most worried about the damage Ta'al may have inflicted on her town.
I hope that our house is not damaged and that our school is okay as well. I miss my school.
Today, the Philippine authorities have maintained that a hazardous eruption could still be imminent. And so for now, despite the mounting frustrations, the evacuation order remains in place.
That report by Howard Johnson. Now to that not-so-earth-shattering question few have ever asked. If two people were to drop a slice of bread at exact opposite points of the globe, would it form the earth into a sandwich? Well, it's a thought two men in New Zealand and Spain had. They've created an earth sandwich by placing bread on precise points either side of the planet, as the BBC's Siobhan Leahy reports.
Etienne Nord, a computer science student in Auckland, said he'd wanted to make an Earth sandwich for years. Using an online longitude and latitude tool, he discovered his exact opposite point was in southern Spain. After posting on the online message board Reddit, he eventually found someone there who was up for the challenge. But, as Etienne explains, then came the tricky part. Making a sandwich with another person when you're on opposite sides of the planet.
We had to try to organize the same kind of bread, which is surprisingly difficult. You'd expect supermarkets around the world to have the exact same kind. Apparently not. We also tried to get both of them facing north, as well as the exact same location, which we use a website for. Then we used Google Maps to try get it fairly accurate.
When they were ready, Etienne travelled with his specially decorated white bread a few hundred metres to find a suitable public spot on his side of the world to place his slice. His Spanish counterpart, however, had to travel 11 kilometres. Reddit users were thrilled when the composite picture showing both men, their bread and their coordinates were then posted on the site. But why even do this in the first place? Etienne says, as well as being a student with plenty of time on his hands, he found it a fun organisational challenge.
It's also quite nice to just know that there is someone at the exact opposite point of the world that has done exactly the same thing as you, but might have spent years of their life doing completely different things. We've never met each other, we've got entirely different lives, but we are now connected by this one point.
Etienne claims theirs is the first bona fide opposite point Earth sandwich. But the first is actually credited to the American artist Zafranc, who organised two slices of baguette to be placed in New Zealand and Spain in 2006. But Etienne says there was big controversy in the Earth sandwich world about the orientation of the baguettes.
The Earth sandwich world had a controversy. That result by Siobhan Leahy. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.